From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the program. We're going to start out tonight with Shelley and Jean Cervantes. They are victim advocates and consultants, and they have an organization, Citizens Against Homicide. Now, what's going to be happening in April, April 12th and 13th in Las Vegas, Nevada, there will be a conference. The Citizens Against Homicide is having their first annual Citizens Against Homicide Victim Awareness Conference, and one of the keynote speakers is Mr. Bill Cosby. Another speaker is someone you're familiar with the program here is Cherry Simpson. And I've been talking to Cherry, and we've been doing shows together for a number of years. So it's great to have Gene, and his daughter will join us in a few minutes on the program this evening. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Nice to have you.
Well, nice to have the opportunity. And just one real quick correction. My daughter's Erin. My wife is Shelley.
I'm sorry. My mistake.
No problem.
And I knew that, too. I'm looking at too many names here, so it's Erin. And you know what? I have a daughter, Erin, too, and I should know better. So I'll kick myself in the tush a little bit later. Anyway, Gene, tell us a little bit about Citizens Against Homicide.
Well, Citizens Against Homicide was established in 1991. Jane Alexander and Jan Miller co-founded the organization. Both had lost a loved one to homicide, and decided that enough of the let's feel sorry for ourselves, we need to be proactive. And as a result, they formed the organization, and we provide support and assist families of homicide victims with crime, with the criminal justice system from beginning to end, as best we possibly can, given some of the restrictions. The majority of our cases are unsolved. That needs to be said for obvious reasons. We would have a great deal of success if we just had the resources, but of course we don't.
Right.
we promote suggestions, I should say provide suggestions for a successful open communication with law enforcement, or if necessary, we act as liaison between families and law enforcement. A lot of the families just are lost when it comes to what do I do next. You know, they just don't have a clear understanding of the law enforcement agencies throughout the United States. Myself, I'm a retired peace officer with the Department of Corrections, 30 years with the department. My daughter, Erin, is a lieutenant at one of the local prisons, Sierra Conservation Center. And so we have a clear understanding of the expectations, what is involved in an investigation, and we often have to bring families back to reality and say, no, this is not law and order.
Yeah, right.
So we do that. We feature victim profiles in our newsletter, our monthly newsletter. It's an opportunity for the family to step outside that box of grief by writing and sharing their story. The newsletter gets national distribution, and we often send extra copies to the family as well as anyone in the local area where the murder took place to garner additional support and media attention. As you know, no one is ever really prepared when violence touches their lives. And, you know, I'll never forget when my family was murdered. I had two family members murdered at the same time. And as a result, I have that empathy for the families that call in for help. They reach out to our organization and say, I need your help. And the thank yous that we get is very heartwarming. We do it because we need to. Somebody has to. We're not going to leave it to the next guy.
Well, it's so important, and Gene Cervantes is here from Citizens Against Homicide. It's so important, Gene, as you know, to get that word out. We do have the crime programs that we see on television that basically focus on a case or two and run with it for, you know, 20, 30, 40 episodes. But the stories of the hundreds of others that are out there looking for help because they're so lost in the system, they can't be told. Now, being in law enforcement yourself for 30 years and your daughter, you use that term empathy. And that's such an important term because the families, and I've interviewed dozens of them on this program and worked with them in my other line of work, the families, I find, seem to bond together and get so strong that they want to do something to help, but they're not sure how to do it. How do you deal with a family who comes to you and said, listen, my son was murdered 6 years ago. We're just nowhere, but the law enforcement can't seem to do anything, but we want to help others. What do you say to those folks?
Just basically what you just said. The bonding is there. It's just very difficult to explain and you've just kind of very simply put, I'll try to. We've experienced exactly what the person who calls and reaches out for help has experienced. So we know the feeling. We know the stages of grief. Some are so obvious. And you get past the feel sorry for yourself, blaming yourself. I could have done this. I should have done that.
Right.
And then finally getting to the point where you say, I'm angry. I want answers. I need to find out what happened to my child or my wife or my daughter or my sister or brother or husband or mother, father. We just have to find out why. Oftentimes we don't get the why, we just get the who.
Yeah.
And even in court, we went through a long, lengthy trial in our family. We were victimized, one, by the murder itself. Then we were victimized again, having to hear everything that went on in there in the defense. And you know, I'm not blaming the defense. They're putting on the best possible defense that they can, which is what they're supposed to do.
Right.
But we listen to the story that, to me, it's a story because it's not factual. It's not what happened. And the end result is satisfying. The when the judge finally says life without possibility of parole twice consecutive, it's something great to hear. And don't ever, and I say this to the families out there, don't ever accept closure. Now we have closure. No, we don't.
No.
There's never any closure. We'll always have that heartache. We'll always have the memory. But there's never closure.
Yeah, I hate that. I hate that term.
I'll give you a very quick example. You lose a finger that you constantly button your shirt with. Now you can't button your shirt, right?
Right.
No, wrong. You could adapt. You find another way of buttoning your shirt. And that's what we do. We cope with the loss of our loved one.
You know, being in the system yourself for 30 years, and go back 30 years and compare it to today, how much has that system changed?
Oh, tremendously. You know, in fact, I just wrote an article for our newsletter, and I titled it Wake Up, because in California, well, throughout the United States, the parole boards are being ordered by courts to release convicted murderers because they've done so well in their programming. And when I started, that wasn't the case. The case was you evaluated a case whether, I'm sorry, a convicted murderer, whether he was ready for parole, you know, what we call suitable for parole, by, or unsuitable for parole, by his commitment offense. Now it's current dangerousness, and there's no way we can prove a negative. I mean, is he a current danger to society? Well, I don't know. Is he not a current danger to society? They're saying yes, because he completed anger management. He completed his high school diploma at age 45 when he should have done it at 18 or 19.
Right.
And they're ordering them paroled. And we need to wake up around this country and say, hey, we're not going to take this anymore. They're convicted murderers, and don't tell me what the courts use as a justification for their decision is temporally remote. The act was temporally remote. And I looked up temporally, and sadly, it is in the past, not eternal, not forever. Well, darn it, death is forever.
Yeah.
And don't insult me by saying the murder of my loved one is temporally remote. Don't insult me. And that's what the courts are doing. So today's, in answer to your question, today's board decisions have changed significantly to favor the convicted murderer. And courts are, for some reason or other, advocating on behalf of the convicted criminal.
Yeah.
And I might add that the state Supreme Court made this decision to do this, and the ordering of convicted murderers to be released, and then the Superior Courts throughout the state has followed suit. But the U.S. Supreme Court, back in January of 11, I believe, indicated that convicted murderers do not have a right to be paroled.
Yeah.
So there's the conflict.
Well, and it's interesting, and you're so right. Gene Cervantes is here. We're talking about Citizens Against Homicide. There will be a conference, the first annual Citizens Against Homicide Victims Awareness Conference, April 12th and 13th in Las Vegas. Bill Cosby is one of the keynote speakers. Click on the link in the show notes to learn more about that. But you're so right, Gene. The consequences of 30 years ago to today are, well, they're just not there. We're hoping to have Erin, your daughter, join us. Is she available?
Yeah, she's you know, just give her another minute or so.
We sure
can. She was scheduled to be in. She's going to school, trying to finish up her college.
Oh, well, good for her.
And she had to email a homework assignment in because we got snowed in, like I was saying.
So we can't say the dog ate her homework in this case.
No. The snow kept her from getting out of here. But I could speak, you know, to the conference, and then when she gets here, she could talk about other things.
Sure. What are the plans for the conference? Now, the first annual, of course, you have Dr. Bill Cosby, Jonathan Raven. What's the conference going to be all about? Who's invited?
Well, the conference is a it's an awareness, like the title says. It's our first annual Victim Awareness Conference. And the invite is to everybody who is interested in learning more about the criminal justice system, learning about the significant changes that are affecting victim rights. A meet and greet session is going to be Friday the 12th.
Right.
It's in the evening, and we'll have some entertainment and some appetizers and what have you, and everybody will be given the opportunity to meet people we've talked with and have a telephone relationship for years and never have had a personal contact. So it'll give us that opportunity. The next day, of course, we're going to start the actual conference, and you mentioned that Cherry Simpson is going to be on the agenda. She's going to be one of the speakers, featured speakers, along with Angela Bushnell Gillum. And Angela and Cherry have both lost loved ones to homicide.
Yep.
There's going to be a poignant video of Angela's daughter, her murder. They caught everything on tape, and that was an enormous help for the law enforcement, the district attorney, to garner a conviction. We're going to also have forensic specialists, medical examiner, forensic specialists. We were hoping to get Bill Sullivan, but I believe he's going to have to. Well, I know he has to beg off, but he's going to send a gentleman, a doctor, in his place, and his name escapes me at this point. And he's going to be talking about the changes in forensics and how DNA and other forensics evidence have led to the enhancement of law enforcement, solving cases, etc., and also how it's negatively affected apprehending or solving crimes. But the medical examiner's decisions as to method of death, suicide, accident, as opposed to homicide, murder. They take the easy way out and say, well, they, meaning the investigators, they take the easy way out by saying, well, the medical examiner said it was an accident. The medical examiner said it was a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And the detectives say, well, but there's no powder burns. There's no gun residue. Well, it was suicide because medical examiner had talked to the first witness, the last person to see him alive. Yeah, he should be the first suspect or prime person of interest. And so a lot of that's going to be discussed. The death penalty is going to be discussed. And the people on that, I'll let Erin is now here, and I'll let her speak to that. Erin.
Hi, Dana.
Hi, Erin. How are you?
I'm good.
Good, good, good. This is Erin Cervantes, and she's one of the co-organizers of this conference. Your dad has been telling us about the conference, doing a great job. If we could, let's get into a little bit about the keynote speakers, in particular, Bill Cosby. How did you arrange that? That sounds great.
Well, through a friend of a friend of a friend. it's funny because the way this all kind of transpired was nothing more than a pipe dream a couple years ago. I'm new to the whole victim advocacy as far as volunteering myself. My family is not new to it. And so I started attending these meetings, and I always thought, that one of the best ways to get our message across would be to bring all these like-minded people together and network and, you know, force by numbers. And then wouldn't it be great? And wouldn't it be great? And I thought, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could get Bill Cosby? Somebody that everybody, he's an icon. He's the iconic father figure for America.
Absolutely.
And having experienced loss as a result of murder himself,
yep,
I just thought this couldn't be more perfect. He's perfect. We have to get him. And so I put my tenacity to work, and the rest is kind of history. So good. we'll be graced with his presence on Saturday evening.
Well, that sounds great. It's the Citizens Against Homicide First Annual Victim Awareness Conference, April 12th and 13th in Las Vegas. And talking to your dad a little bit about Citizens Against Homicide, we've got about 4 minutes left here, Aaron. Tell us your thoughts on the organization.
I think the organization is, unfortunately, there aren't enough of us, and there's not enough organizations like us.
Right.
When I say that I'm new to this, as far as the whole victim advocacy thing and actually being involved in the organizations, sitting on the periphery, sitting on the outside looking in, it's victim advocates in general give a gift that is just invaluable. The fact that you have somebody listening to you that has taken a vested interest in helping you either solve your case, get the word out there that it is unsolved, making communications, contacts with law enforcement agencies and the multitude of law enforcement agencies. I think that most people sit down with their family in the evening and they watch CSI and they watch Law and Order, and it's really hard for them to wrap their head around the complexity of the criminal justice system. And so that's where we come in and kind of hold their hand and guide them through and sort of speak the same language that law enforcement does and get answers for these folks. So I, and then, you know, we have the billboard, the reward for information billboards that we do also. So without these resources, I don't know what these people would do. I don't know where they would turn.
Exactly. Your dad was mentioning, and I couldn't agree more, a term that I don't like to use on this program is called closure, because there never is closure in a case like this. Your family has experienced homicide. Many have. Many families out there without answers. And even when they do get them, there's never closure. So we got to get that word out of the vocabulary, I think. Cherry Simpson, I can't let the night go without mentioning her.
Of course not.
There is I call her the salt of the earth. Her family, I've interviewed Cherry many times, her daughter. She too, her family is victims from, as a result of homicide, domestic violence especially. The Cherry Simpsons of the world, we sure need a lot more of them, do we not?
Absolutely. She's got this fire inside of her that is just, it's contagious.
Yeah.
It is, it's awe-inspiring. She's an amazing gal.
Yep.
And there's no end in sight for her either. She's got no intention of giving up her fight for these victims and getting the word out and doing what she can to prevent things that happen to her family to happen to others.
Just being there to listen is half of it. And the rest of it is the system. And, you know, we could do a two-hour program on that. And like I say, Cherry, you have her speaking on domestic violence, I believe. She's a fantastic speaker. I wished I had half of her energy and a quarter of her desire, because I'd be going steady and working hard all the time. I think I do, but nobody can keep up to her.
Dana, it's also worth noting that the days of the 70s where the tendency was to side with the victim and to sympathize with the victim, those times are changed.
They're gone.
And the tables have essentially turned. And so people like Cherry that have not allowed that to discourage her pursuit is just absolutely, it's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. The Citizens Against Homicide Victim Awareness Conference, April 12th and 13th in Las Vegas, Nevada. Bill Cosby is the keynote speaker. Many other great speakers there, including our own friend Cherry Simpson. Gene and Aaron Cervantes, thank you for coming on the program. Good luck with the conference.
Dana, can I give our website?
Absolutely.
To your audience. Our website is all one word, citizensagainsthomicide.org, and we encourage your listeners to log on, research just who we are, and if ever they or their friends, relatives, anybody that they come in contact with needs our services or thinks they need it, just call and we could talk with them. We'll be glad to say yes, we can help, and we would also be just as quick to say I'm sorry we can't help for these reasons. But at least inquire, give us a call if we can help.
Sounds fantastic. And I'm going to throw an idea out, and we'll talk about it more off air. I would love to, during the conference, get a hold of you on the phone again sometime, and maybe we could do a program while the conference is going on to promote it at the same time.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Well, we'll certainly talk to about that and see what we can try and figure out. Anyway, thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Dana.
Thank you, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
That's Gene and Aaron Cervantes. I can't believe I said Shelley at the start. Oh, well. And that's the Citizens Against Homicide Victim Awareness Conference, April 12th and 13th in Las Vegas, Nevada. Dr. Bill Cosby is going to be one of the keynote speakers, and our own friend of the program, Cherry Simpson, will be there too. Go to citizensagainsthomicide.org. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with our own friend Pat Brown, criminal profiler, talking about her new book, The Murder of Cleopatra. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Always a favorite guest to have on the program, criminal profiler Pat Brown is here to talk about her new book, The Murder of Cleopatra, and other things. Pat, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Dana.
Nice to have you. Listen, before we get into the book, I want to get your thoughts on Christopher Dorner. Wow. You know, just, and I think I've said this to you many times, just when we finished talking about our story, I said, turn the TV on tomorrow, there'll be a different story. But who thought we'd see a story like that? Your thoughts on the crazy former LAPD police officer and his manifesto?
Well, first of all, he is a spree, kind of a spree killer, but he's almost very similar to a mass murderer in the sense that he has the same type of grievances as a mass murderer, going out there and killing a bunch of people and having his day in the sun. So there's really nothing unusual about him. As far as his manifesto goes, who cares?
Yeah.
Really, quite frankly, I don't care what he says. He's a psychopath. He's a murderer. I don't care what he says in his manifesto. He's griping about the world. He's griping about being, you know, people being unfair to him and getting a raw deal. And if all of us went out and killed people because we got a raw deal in life, there wouldn't be anybody left on the planet. So, quite frankly, I don't care what he has to say, you know. And what made me really angry is that people focused on what he said rather than what he did, than giving credibility to anything he said. Now, I'm sure the LAPD does have its problems. Every organization does. But we do not have to listen to Dorner because he's already proven what he is. And the LAPD was smart getting rid of him because they were dealing with a psychopath.
Absolutely. And when you think about it, and those that were cheering him on, for lack of a better term, I guess in today's society, how sick is that?
Yeah, I mean, just because they have a grievance themselves with police organizations, that, you know, that's really, quite frankly, is that a reason to cheer somebody on? The same reason you would have if somebody says, oh, I was bullied in school, so let's cheer him on for killing off school children. And I do want to mention, since I have taken a stand against speaking on mass murderers, I did speak about Dorner because he was on the loose, and you know he was a danger to people out in society. So I was willing to talk about him, but I did take a stand back during the Aurora shootings. I said, you know, I will no longer speak about any specific mass murder, use his name or face. I'll speak about mass murders in general, but I won't speak on a specific one. So when the shootings happened in Connecticut, I turned down about 20 shows, and turned down a whole bunch recently on which just some of the news that came out.
Yeah, I know.
Yesterday, and I said, sorry, I won't talk about it. I'll talk about mass murders, and everybody pretty much hung up on me. My point was, you know, we in the media need to stop giving these guys a lot of publicity, making them want to go out and, you know, the next mass murder to go out and...
He's the last person that needs any PR, and sadly, I guess that's what I'm doing here right now. But what?
He wasn't quite the same thing as a normal mass murderer. So that's the only reason I talked about Dorner.
Yeah.
But the rest of them who just go in and shoot a place and kill a pile of people, they want to beat out the last guy, and they want some better publicity. So the media needs to get together and start saying, we're just not going to talk about the guy. We'll talk about the victims, and we're just not going to talk about them. We'll just talk about mass murders in general. We'll just say, here's another mass murder on the loose. What a creep. And they all have the same background. They all have the same gripes. They all do it the same way. We really don't need to refer to the part again and go over it and keep saying his name and putting his picture up there and, you know, making him a hero.
Absolutely. Pat Brown's here talking about, or will now be talking about, her new book, The Murder of Cleopatra. Publication date is today from our old friends at Prometheus Books. The myths of Cleopatra's death. Pat, is there any truth to the rumor that you're going to exhume the body and have Michael Bodden do a new autopsy?
I know, I would love to do that. There's a place out west of Alexandria called Taposaurus.
Yeah.
Taposaurus Magna, I believe. And I went out to visit this archaeological site, and Dr. Havisa Zahihuas and Kathleen Martinez. I'm going to get this wrong, and she'll be mad at me. But they were out there doing the excavations, and they believe that's where Cleopatra is buried. I don't know that there's proof of that yet, but it's not a bad thought. It's, you know, quite a ways west, and I guess Octavian just wanted to get her out of town so there wouldn't be a place for them, you know, everybody in town to go worship at. You know, the same reason, you know, you want to supposedly toss Osama bin Laden at sea, so there's no place to go worship him and go to his grave and make him a hero there, a martyr. You know, put her out there 30 miles to the west of Alexandria, and you want to take your donkey out there, fine, but you're not going to go down the main street and do it. So I think it could be there, and I'll call Bodden when I'll find out that she is.
Now, you say that this is history's greatest cold case. Why?
Well, what really is so strange about this, the Cleopatra's death, is that for 2,000 years, we've just bought the story. So we have one guy, essentially, Plutarch, who wrote his story 100 years after her death. So he wasn't around to be really knowing what was going on. And maybe he had some papers, maybe he heard some stories. I don't know where he got his info from. But he has been, you know, his story has gone down for 2,000 years without much question. Now, it's one thing to say, Plutarch told a good story. Here it is. But it's another thing to say, this is true. And this is what we should believe. And really, it's just incredible to me that this story wasn't suspicious. And it was just hook, line, and sinker. And I did the Discovery documentary back in 2004.
Right.
And I debunked the snake back then, said, I don't believe she killed herself with a snake. I presented the evidence. And then I mentioned right at the end that I believe she was murdered, but being a 45-minute show, you know. Didn't go into that. And I've then went back and started doing more research on what I think really happened to her. And the story just really captivated me, because it's not even just about the fact I believe she was murdered, but why she was murdered and what led up to it. And her whole, what happened to Cleopatra in her life, and especially in the last year, is really something that nobody's ever examined. Like, I believe, for example, that she was never hiding in her tomb. You know, that's what the story is. Octavian was coming her way, and, you know, after she and Antony lost a battle at Actium, and supposedly Cleopatra just ran off and left Antony, and then the lovesick bastard, you know, just followed her, followed to Egypt and left his men to die. And then they drank and were, drank themselves to death for the next year while they were waiting to be, you know, conquered. And then when Octavian got there, she hid in her tomb and made some stupid demands, and he didn't do, you know, he didn't accept them, and then, you know, she got trapped and she killed herself. That's the story. And it's a horribly bad story about Cleopatra. And the whole story about Actium is not true. And I've documented why I believe it's absolutely not true that she ran off and Antony didn't know what was going on. And they planned They planned to escape because they were losing the battle, so they planned to leave as many ships as they could, taking the treasure with them. And they went back to Egypt, and she spent that year trying to get out of Egypt, to try to take her fleet out of Egypt and to move her base of operations. She was not sitting there just hiding and waiting and twiddling her thumbs. She was planning to take her fleet to India. And there's a lot of evidence to support that, and that's what I spent the last years doing, is putting together all the evidence so that people can see that there is a different story. And I think it's a much more fascinating story than we've ever been led to believe by Plutarch, the Dan Brown of his time.
Pat Brown, criminal profiler, is here talking about her new book, The Murder of Cleopatra, available in bookstores online, Amazon and all those places, starting today from Prometheus Books. You know, what most of us think about the Cleopatra, the story we've seen in Hollywood, the movies, etc., and of course, your documentary in 2004. What got Pat Brown to think about Cleopatra with all the other work that you're doing?
Well, mostly it was a documentary that started it all. And quite frankly, you know, I really hadn't paid much attention to her. Mm-hmm. You know, I believed the story like everybody else did as I was growing up. And that was just a story I'd always heard about ancient history. I was contacted by Atlantic Productions, who was doing this show on Cleopatra. And if you know a little bit about television, you know how the producers sit around an office and say, what can we come up with?
Yeah, exactly.
What can we come up with that'll make a good show, that'll be controversial, that'll make people watch the thing? And they throw ideas around it, and a lot of times there's no real validity behind the ideas. It's just, hey, let's see what we can get out of this one. And they called me up and said, what do you think about Cleopatra? Anything, the story about their death that unique or interesting and different? I'm like, really? Are you trying to dredge something up here? And they didn't have anything to tell me. They were just looking for something to hang their hat on. And so I said, well, okay, well, I'll go check it out. But I really wasn't thinking there was going to be anything there. But when I started reading the same story after the same story after the same story, and I'm going, really? She snuck a cobra in a basket of figs past a guard? I mean, here's supposedly Octavian's just dying to take her back to Rome, which I don't believe is true. But he was dying to take her back to Rome and have her in his triumph. He puts one lousy guard out there who's got the IQ of a 6-year-old. Because if that guard let that big basket in without checking it out thoroughly, he wasn't going to have a head in the morning.
Exactly.
So, who does that? If you really want this woman to go back to Rome with you, I mean, I would have her, I'd have guards on the inside. I'd have her tied up. I'm not going to put her in a tomb and have one guard watch. So, I mean, the whole story right there was going, this is crazy. This doesn't make any sense. And so the more and more I examined it, the more idiotic the story became. And so I called Atlantic Productions back and said, okay, I'm in on this one. And, that was what started it. And then I just became more and more fascinated with the entire story because there were so many red flags, things that you just, make you go, really? Could that be true? Like, there's a funny story about when Anthony supposedly has committed suicide, and his men bring him over to Cleopatra, and she won't open the door and let him in. And mind you, she has her own guards at the door, but for some reason she prefers to put a rope around the poor dying man and haul his 200-pound body up the side of a wall into the windows, which are about 4 flights up. Really? And nobody's questioning this story. And I'm thinking, well, you have Cleopatra, who's 39 years old and I don't think is a weightlifter, and her two handmaidens who probably lift combs, and these three women can actually haul this man up 4 stories of a building on a rope.
Wow.
Nobody's questioned this.
Yeah, exactly.
Why is this not questioned?
Lots of questions. Many, many answers. The book, The Murder of Cleopatra, History's Greatest Cold Case, available today from our friend, criminal profiler Pat Brown. Pat, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Dana.
Talk to you. Bye-bye.
All right.
That's Pat Brown, criminal profiler. I sat down earlier today with Robin Sachs. You know Robin from this show for many, many years. She was an assistant district attorney in Los Angeles County. She's now a legal analyst at MyFox LA in Los Angeles to talk about Christopher Dorner. And you won't believe who called Robin Sachs to talk about Christopher Dorner. Here's what Robin had to say.
Okay, we're back. This is Gary.
glued to the television, the internet, wherever, watching the Christopher Dorner manhunt, I guess, for lack of a better term. Some of the best coverage I saw was from my old friend Robin Sachs. You remember her, regular guest on the program, and now she's a legal analyst at MyFox LA, and I thought, what better person to call than Robin Sachs herself. Hi, Robin.
Hi there.
Nice to have you back on the program.
So nice to be back. I feel like I'm, you know, it's like a little bit of a high school reunion.
Yeah, I don't know about that. That would be pretty scary. But anyway, listen, say what you want about Los Angeles. That town is gone through something here in the last couple of weeks that the police department, the family, everything. And watching and covering the Christopher Dorner case as you did, I'm going to throw you the ball here in a second. I want you to share a little bit about what has happened since Christopher Dorner has taken his own life, I guess what the reports are saying.
Well, first of all, you know, Dana, you and I go back a long time, and so you know, it's no secret out there that I've always been very much a pro-justice, yep, pro-victim, you know, pro-law and order, if you will, type of person, and I remain to be that person. I think it's been very confusing at this time because there is a feeling that because I made a decision to look into the claims that Chris Dorner was making, that somehow I have given him some sort of elevated status.
And, no.
You know, I look at this, and you kind of alluded to this as you just did your intro, saying, you know, as you covered the Chris Dorner case, well, I kind of actually looked at myself a little bit, not the person covering the Chris Dorner case. I kind of look at myself as covering everything around the Chris Dorner case as opposed to the Chris. People who were covering the manhunt, that wasn't me.
Right.
I wasn't the ones in the mountains of Big Bear. I wasn't the ones who were in Corona. I wasn't at any of the fallen police officer's funerals. That was the Chris Dorner story coverage. And I wasn't active in that part. I was very active and interested when I read his manifesto. And I can tell you, as I sat in, and I was literally in a hair and makeup chair as I was reading the manifesto for the first time, and I'm reading it very slowly and carefully. And I looked at it and I said, you know, there's some things that he is saying that ring true, and he challenged the media world to look into what he was claiming and what he was saying. And I, you know, like everybody else, wanting to understand all the trauma and tragedy and fright and fear that was going on around me, felt, well, the best, you know, everybody out there was saying, you look at the manifesto as for the clues. I was looking for clues, but it took me in a different direction than it took everybody else.
The Robin Sachs that I know and the Robin Sachs who I saw doing the coverage on this case from a different angle would be the very last person that would go and try to justify any of Chris Dorner's alleged murders, attempt murders. What he did was despicable. Did I get that right?
You absolutely got it right. I mean, I do not look at Chris Dorner in any way, shape, or form as a hero, as some sort of a brave person who saw justice in a different form. I don't. I really divorce myself from the Chris Dorner person. I feel that it was tragic and awful that it got to where it got to. But, you know, that's my sympathy. Ends when you start shooting innocent people. I mean, I'd have a very different view of him if he had picked up the phone and gave me a call prior to doing any of these horrific acts. But now, having said that, you know, the aftermath of this is, I think very hard for anybody in the media, and frankly, for anyone who was in the DA's office and in the media to go out there and say at a time where the acts are so heinous and despicable to say, but I'm going to look at whether or not he has credence and is there anything that's believable what he's saying, because I think idealistically you want to write this guy off as a complete lunatic nut who's not making any sense. But kind of, I mean, I think it's my job and I believe it's my duty as I sit here and speculate about someone's case and someone's motives to look at all the angles, and that's what I did.
when you talk about this, and credence is a strong word when it comes to this case and what we've seen, you actually talked to Chris Dorner's mother, did you not?
I did. She reached out to me. A lot of people have reached out to me. Let me start there. I mean, all of a sudden, it was very interesting. I kind of felt for a minute I was probably both a very well-respected person and a very hated individual all during the same week, and that was what it felt like. I mean, I right. definitely could see why people would say, why is Robin Tax on television saying anything in any way that gives that in any way, shape, or form appears to be beneficial to him because this guy is such a monster. But I, and yet at the same time, there were a lot of people saying, you know what, this case was. And I'm not just talking about citizens or people who are, you know, news and views watchers and that kind of stuff, or people who've been necessarily even individually wrong. I'm talking about cops. I'm talking about law enforcement folks coming out of the woodwork, and I'm not talking about in small numbers. I mean, in large numbers, people reaching out to me in any way that they could find me, whether it be through radio shows, through Facebook, through Fox Mail, from my email to finding my cell phone to Twitter, people have reached out to me who are people who are proud law enforcement members, people who love their job and feel proud and brave to do what they do, and yet felt like the department had an institutional, and when I say the department of LAPD had an institutional and has an institutional problem that bears looking into. And through that, as I started discussing some of the people that contacted me, and I mean, really powerful stuff. Dave. I mean, someone, you know, people calling me and saying, I could have been Chris Dorner, but for the fact that I have children. I could have been Chris Dorner. I felt that rage, that kind of rage, but for the fact that I'm married and have a family. And when you hear someone, I mean, it's like, that's, you know, it's like comparing yourself to Hitler in a way. I mean, to even say that is really brave. So it warranted me to at least look into the documents, to look into the tapes, to look into the records that were available to and make and see if I can kind of separate, you know, the ball of yarn here. And I think that as I did it with I attempted to do a surgical precision. I don't know if I have, but in trying to keep things clean, I think that my voice resonated with Chris Dorner's mom in that she saw me as a fair individual, and I did not reach out to her, and she had had, you know, she was dealing with herself, hundreds of thousands of media people calling, emailing, writing, and all that kind of stuff, and she chose to call me.
Robin Sachs is here. You can see her on My Fox LA. Check out her webpage at robinsachs.com. One of my commentaries that I do, as you know, daily, talked about Chris Dorner, and the aftermath of this, in my opinion, will bring a whole new light, or at least it should bring a whole new light into what I called police department internal investigations. The type of, and they're called different things, different places, professional standards, internal affairs, public complaints, whatever. Just a quick thought, and I know you're going to be doing more on this as the days and weeks go by, but what's your take on the LAPD and law enforcement in California? Will there be a review of internal affairs matters? Whether Chris Dorner is vindicated, so to speak, in the case that caused him to be fired, he can never be vindicated for what he did after, or not, should not internal affairs matters be looked at more thorough now?
You know, that's exactly the question I, along with my anchor extraordinaire, Phil Schumann, are going to ask on Friday night. We're doing a special on My Fox LA. We'll stream online as well as be available there. Sorry to give a plug there, but we are really looking into this. And we are looking at cases, and we have reached out to LAPD to ask, number one, are they going to continue with what they said that they were going to do, which was reopen and relook at the Dorner case? Number two, how are they going to are they going to look at it then? And number three, is there going to be any sort of systemic change that's going to result? I'm just curious. I don't have the answers at this moment as to what I think about LAPD. Yeah, it's too soon for me to do that. I can't decide yet. I'm hearing
on a one at a time basis, right? There's thousands of law enforcement members, and you know, so I can't put into perspective the percentage of number of people out there that are really Chris Dorners, but one Chris Dorner feels like one too many at this moment. So I've been, you know, I am hearing similar stories from people who don't know each other, who are both within the department, some of the left department, and fire department. And the racism is kind of one, is the issue that jumped off the pages of the manifesto, and I think that's definitely an issue that's being more personal, that I find more worrisome and potentially having longer, greater negative effects, is the fear of retaliation in terms of being able to report your superiors. That what I found in the documentation from the Dorner case in that regard was just as troubling, if not more troubling, as the race.
Yeah, call it being a whistleblower, call it whatever. One of the principles of policing, and you know what I do as a living besides talking on the radio, is the people are the police and the police are the people. When you have the police policing their own, it's always been a question in my 30 years of law enforcement, is that the right thing to do? Can we prevent another Christopher Dorner from happening? I consider it a big basket of apples, Robin, with Chris Dorner being the rotten one so far. And is this something? And you know what? It may be working very well, and you and I are wrong, or is there a big perspective here that needs to be looked at? And I will stay in touch with you and keep watching My Fox LA, and Friday night on, give that one more time, please.
It's Friday night at 10:30 Pacific time, and you'll be streaming on myfoxla.com.
I'll be watching. Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. Now, Robin Sachs is a longtime friend of the program. She's taken a lot of heat for the type of reporting that she's done on this case, and you know, I got to make it perfectly clear. She is not vindicating or supporting any actions of Christopher Dorner. What he did was reprehensible, despicable, terrible, whatever. He was a scourge that is no longer here, and that's a good thing. But the big picture still needs to be looked at. That's it. I'm Dana Pretzer. I hope you enjoyed tonight's show, and we'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to The Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.